Breaking apartment news. The champion people, you know, the people with the good apartments, bring you River Park of Dublin with this amazing deal.
No rent until 2026. Live in one of the coolest places in the city, right by Bridge Park, and you will not pay rent until next year.
I don't believe it.
I lie a lot, but not about this.
River Park of Dublin. Great location, great amenities, and now a great special. Okay, now go to livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. When you hear the word vampire, what comes to mind? Fangs? Blood drinking? Garlic? Wooden stake? Me too. enigmatic characters who grace the pages of our fantasy novels, sexy and mysterious creatures of the night who command the screen on our favorite TV shows and movies. We may even know somebody in real life or on TikTok who claims to be the real deal, and they seem a little too convincing to be anything but. There may be subtle differences from one story to the next, but we know a vampire when we see it. Right? We know. Now, where do our modern understandings of vampires come from? Can we see the traits that we know so well today in the folklore? Can we see them reflected in the historic record of purportedly real cases? Have they always been the way that we have come to expect them to be? Tonight's guest may be able to shed some sunlight on the matter. A.P. Sylvia, author of Vampires of Lore, Traits, and Modern Misconceptions, will be joining us momentarily. But before we sink our teeth into it, do me a favor and please like this video. And if you are watching on YouTube, make sure that you are subscribed. That helps the channel grow and it helps me to convince other cool people like AP Sylvia to join me on this program. And tonight we are doing something a little different. We are streaming to a couple of different platforms, Twitch and maybe not Facebook. Oh, no. I'm getting an error message. I might be on Facebook right now. So anybody who can comment, let me know. For anybody who is viewing this on those platforms, thank you so much. And put something in the chat so I can see that you're there. And thank you so much to those of you who are going to be watching and listening to this on the replay. Y'all rock. This is going to be an awesome show tonight. I'm really looking forward to this. If you have any burning questions at all regarding vampires or their lore, tonight is the night, okay? Because this will be our first vampire-focused guest on this show. We've been going almost 5 years, so this is the first. Anything could happen, anything could happen, but, you know, maybe just it might be a while before we get another one. So put those questions in the chat. And with that, let's go ahead and formally invite our guest inside. I will stop with the puns. I will stop that. AP Sylvia has long had an interest in supernatural beliefs, with a particular focus on vampire folklore. In his book, Vampires of Lore, Traits, and Modern Misconceptions, he explores how our modern notions about vampires compare to the folkloric beliefs of the past. His writing has appeared in the Journal of Vampire Studies, Voices from the Vaults, and the online review of Rhode Island History. He's been a guest on local and nationally syndicated radio programs, as well as a variety of podcasts. He also runs the website locationsoflore.com, where he talks about his visits to unique places, including alleged vampire graves. I think we're going to have to talk about that. Please welcome to the program, AP Sylvia. Hello.
Hello, Kristen. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining me. Really been looking forward to this. Really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
Learned a lot. I'll talk about it a little bit. Very surprising information. I think tonight I just wanted to start out kind of getting more of a sense of your backstory with and your experience with the supernatural, and kind of dig into Locations of Lore a little bit, because I did check out your blog as well, and fascinating stuff. You're an amazing writer. I know, I'm sure you've been doing it for a while, but just an incredible writer, the way that you put information together. It's very educational, but very entertaining. So with that, I think maybe if you would like to introduce yourself to folks and just give us a little bit of that background and backstory on yourself.
Sure. Well, I've long been interested, ever since I was a kid, in sort of folklore and supernatural beliefs and mythology and things like that. Even when I was just a little guy, my mother bought me a book about ghosts. It was, talked about kind of folklore and beliefs around ghosts and stuff. And I thought it was the coolest thing. And I still have it. I liked Greek mythology and things like that. So just anything that was sort of, strange, supernatural, unorthodox things you wouldn't like normally encounter. I always thought that was very interesting. And so I've kind of, kept with that interest, watched, documentaries and TV shows and things like that, that I caught my fancy, thought was fun. And I liked, a spooky movie or that sort of thing. So it was always something that I've liked and sort of was with me. I got sort of serious into the researching of it some years back, when I was, I visited, Ripley's Believe It or Not, auditorium. If you've ever been to one of those, they're a lot of fun.
Yeah, I used to live in L.A., like a couple of blocks from the Ripley's there.
Oh, yeah, I've been there.
Hollywood, yeah.
Yeah, I've been to that one. Yeah, that's great. Okay. That's great. So there's a number of them around the country, and they've got all kinds of neat things and, Believe It or Not, all sorts of fun stuff there. So I was in New York at the time, visiting, and it was at Times Square, and there's a Ripley's there. And so we walked by it, and I was with my wife, who's my girlfriend at the time, now my wife. And I was like, oh, we got to go in. We have to go and check it out. And so we go in there, and it's great. All sorts of fun stuff. And they've got this really spooky area down in like kind of maybe a lower level. And they've got something that's labeled as a vampire killing kit behind glass there. And it's this wooden box, and it's got these like little vials in it. And, there's like a mold for making silver bullets and whatnot. And I was like, what's this all about? And according to the label, it was, they were supposedly sold to people who were visiting Eastern Europe, who were worried about, getting attacked by vampires and that kind of thing. And I thought that was neat. And afterwards, when I got home, I just sort of, it kept rolling around in my mind. I'm like, what's the deal with that thing? Like, are there more of them? What's going on? And so I started looking into them, and there's some controversy surrounding them. I found out that some people claim that they are authentic pieces that are from the 1800s. And then there are other people that argue, well, they're actually modern constructions using materials from the 1800s. So someone takes a box from the 1800s and some vials from the 1800s and kind of, a piece of wood and sticks it all together and labels it as such. And one of the arguments for it being kind of a modern thing, I was like, well, this sort of reflects modern notions about vampires and pop culture things, and it's not really what anyone would have believed. And I was like, well, what did people believe then? What's the story there? And I started kind of looking around and doing a little research about, you know, kind of true beliefs about vampires. What do people really believe? And I had watched some documentaries in the past and I knew it didn't quite line up. And I just started digging more and more. And I found, you know, I started going down different paths and finding different things and all sorts of beliefs from different countries. And I sort of wound up writing the book that you showed earlier, Vampires of Lore. Mm-hmm. And I sort of answered my question of like, okay, well, what I see in a movie, is that what people actually believe? Because we tend to think of that. We tend to think, oh yeah, like I saw Dracula. I know what people believed about vampires, but it's not necessarily the case. And that's the interesting bit to me.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Backtrack. I'm going to have to keep my questions in my head. So that first encounter with the vampire killing kit, at the Ripley's, was that when like the interest in vampires entered the picture, that was the start of it?
I think that was when I had the focus for them. I've always been interested in all kinds of different things, different legends and monsters and stuff like that. You know, so, and vampires were sort of among them, like, oh, that's interesting. But then I was like, well, now I have a question I want to really answer. And so that I sort of narrowed my focus down, and that's what really caused me to dive deep into it.
Okay. Do you write about vampire subjects or like the graves that you have visited on Locations of Lore?
Yes. If you go to Locations of Lore, there's a link. There's like a categories link there, and one of the categories is vampires, and you can see a number of different articles I've written on some of the different vampire graves I've visited, and some other kind of vampire adjacent things. I saw some of the original handwritten notes from Bram Stoker when I visited Philadelphia, so that kind of thing too. But yes, a number of grave sites are shown. I've got pictures and talk about sort of the incident that happened around why people think this person was a vampire.
Mm-hmm. Okay, can you share one of those stories with us?
Sure. So, you know, I think one I sort of like to talk about a bit is, you know, we often think about vampires as like Transylvania, you know, Eastern Europe, and that's where they live, and that's where it happened, and that's it. And that's really a product of Dracula, of the novel Dracula, and its impact on, you know, kind of our you know, modern media. But there's vampire beliefs from all over the place, and there were many vampire incidents actually in New England, you know, the United States. One of the last vampire incident in New England took place in 1892. So it was a long time ago, but at the same time, like, not a crazy long time ago, right? So 1892, in Exeter, Rhode Island. So it involved a young woman named Mercy Brown. Mercy Lena Brown. And essentially she, the Brown family had lost a number of members of it to tuberculosis, which was then known as consumption. Mm-hmm. And so basically consumption, you know, people, there's kind of, it can present in kind of a couple different ways. Sometimes someone will be sick over a long period of time and sort of deteriorate, or sometimes people can get sick and seemingly get sick and pass away very, very quickly. So the Brown family, the mother of the Brown family and an older sister had passed away some years ago. Mercy passed away from consumption a couple years later, and then her brother Edwin, her older brother Edwin, was also sick and dying of consumption. So Edwin had gone to Colorado Springs in the hope of like a cure. That was sort of a common thing. People would go out west because they thought the kind of moist air of New England was causing the illness. And so he goes out there, and while he's out there, his younger sister Mercy passes away, and he doesn't really get any better. So he comes home essentially to kind of die among family. So the medical community at this point, there's nothing there. They had no treatment for tuberculosis. There was nothing that they could really do. So it was just sort of watching him sort of slowly kind of pass away. And what happens is, while he's home, some members of the community come forward and approach Edwin's father, George Brown, and they say, there could be something we could do to save him. And it may be, in fact, that the other members of your family who passed away, one of them is actually causing his illness. And that's the reason he's dying. And so if we take action against the dead person who's causing the illness, then we could save your son. Right. So at first, George Brown, he's not interested in it. He doesn't want to do that. But eventually he relents. And so some members of the community, they go to the local cemetery in Exeter, and they exhume the body of his deceased wife and an older daughter. And they also exhume the body of Mercy. When communities would do this sort of thing, they would often look for vampiric signs, indications that something is not right, not expected, unnatural with the corpse. And when they looked at the mother and older sister, they had been dead for quite a while. They had deteriorated to the point that they were beyond suspicion. They looked at those, and that was nothing seemed amiss. Mercy had only been dead about, I think it was two months at the time, something like that. She had died in winter, so she hadn't actually been buried in the ground. She was in a crypt in the cemetery. And so when they examined her body was still kind of well preserved. And they removed her heart and her liver. And they looked at the heart. They found blood in it. And while there was a doctor there who really didn't want to have anything to do with it, but he was the community doctor, so he was there, Dr. Metcalf. He said, this is all normal. There's nothing strange here. But the community, they saw the blood in the heart, and they said, this is the proof. If there's blood in the heart, that means that this person is somehow stealing the life, stealing the vitality of the living. So they took the heart, they took the liver, they burned it in the cemetery to ashes. They took the ashes and they mixed them with water. They then gave the ashes to Edwin to drink as a cure for his consumption.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anyone would be surprised to find out that it did not work. Edwin passes away short time later. And that normally would have probably been the end of it. And no one wouldn't want to have talked about it after
mm-hmm.
that. But a local newspaper, the Providence Journal, caught wind of the incident. And they were very interested in it. And so within like a couple of days, they printed like two different articles about it, talking about what was done, and they kind of, you know, sensationalizing it a bit. And subsequently, local papers over the years would publish things about it again, because it was very interesting, very shocking to everyone. And so that's very much why we know about it today. And we know so much about it today, because of these various articles that got printed in local newspapers talking about it. But you know, and that's just one of a number of different incidents that happened in New England, which I think is, you know, certainly not the place you tend to think of having
you don't.
Sort of a history in vampires, which is sure, but not so much vampires.
Yeah, not the first thing you think of, but very, very interesting historical fact. Yes. Was that did I miss it? Did you say you were able to visit? Is it Mercy Brown's grave?
I did. I went to Exeter, Rhode Island. I visited her grave there. It's still there. The Browns are all there. You can see Edwin's grave, and you can see her father and her siblings and mother. It's still an active cemetery. So you know, when you do go there, if people go there, you obviously want to be respectful, and you want to you know, sort of not make a scene, because there may be mourners there. And if you go to the cemetery, you can see some pictures I took of her grave. There's a number of like trinkets and tokens and things that people have left there. So it's a bit of a pilgrimage, I think, for some folks. So you can see all sorts of different things that people leave at her grave. you know, because of the story.
Yeah. Okay. All right. The indicator that every, you know, not the doctor, but the villagers, they were like, oh my gosh, she's definitely a vampire. The heart with the blood, like liquid blood.
Yeah, liquid blood. The doctor said it was, I think that there was some disagreement as to the freshness of it. I think from the doctor's point of view, it was not that fresh and kind of coagulated, but people felt it was fresh. So, but yes, traditionally, liquid blood in the heart is an indication that someone's a vampire.
Okay. What other indicators would lend suspicion to a person?
There were a number. Basically, anything that made the dead body seem like it was still living when it's not. So the body looking fresh or undecomposed, new skin showing, new nails showing. If someone looks like they've gained weight, if the color of their face is kind of pinkish or red, they sort of look healthy and they might look better than they did in life, when they're viewed, you know, in the grave. Anything like that would be an indication that something unnatural is happening here. This person's vitality is being preserved at the cost of the vitality of the living people around them.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that we tend to, I think people then and now tend to think of when someone dies, they eventually turn into a skeleton.
Right.
And if you were to look at someone who's been dead X amount of time, they will look somewhere between what they looked like when they died and skeleton, right? Moving in that direction. But that's actually not necessarily what happens during the decomposition process. A lot of things can happen. Not to get too, I don't want to get too graphic here on the show. during decomposition, bodies can bloat. They can kind of gain in size because of buildups of gases. Skin can kind of slough off, and the layers of skin underneath could look like fresh skin to people who don't know what they're looking at. If nails fall off, the nail beds underneath can look like new nails to people who, again, don't know what they're looking at. As skin recedes, it can look like hair has grown or nails have grown, all that kind of thing. And also blood around the mouth. That is a natural thing that can happen. That fluid can exit the body and be around the mouth and nose. So imagine you've got your suspicion that, you know, this person who's been dead for, you know, X amount of time, some months or whatever, is causing other people to die. You open up their grave and they've got a mouthful of blood. You're like, that's what, you know, what else are you looking for? There's the vampire, you know? So it was oftentimes a misinterpretation of natural processes that were going on.
Okay. Let's dig into the people a little bit that sure. might fall under suspicion. In this earlier edition of Vampire, what and who are these people? Was this like your aristocrat kings and
no,
rich people?
not Yeah, I mean, I know in movies and stuff, it's always, you know, some count or an aristocrat who lives in a big, you know, a dark and stormy castle, you know, whatever. By and large, no, it wasn't some aloof, you know, kind of, you know, elite figure. It was friends and neighbors often. It was people who were in the community. It often depended, I think, on kind of what was going on. So if there was some kind of disease that was spreading through a village, or some kind of misfortune was going on, the kind of finger of blame might point towards the deceased, right? So, and you can put yourself in the minds of these people, like, and again, this is before germ theory and things like that, right? So they didn't have the benefit of the knowledge we do now about infection. So, you know, someone who seemed kind of young and healthy suddenly gets sick and dies unexpectedly. Wow, why was that? And then a short time later, another person gets sick and dies, and then another, and now we have another person who's sick and dying. Well, what's going on here? What started? Well, it all started when that first person died.
Yeah.
What's going on with that first person? Let's take a look at them. And they would exhume the grave and look for the signs. So sometimes it would simply be kind of a matter of chance of what was going on. There were also a lot of other beliefs about what might make someone become a vampire when they do die. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's in folklore, it would be someone who, it's really a laundry list of things. If they were an evil person in life, they were kind of an evildoer. They died in a state of sin, they committed suicide. If they practiced black magic, that was definitely a thing. But there are also beliefs like, oh, if a cat jumps over the corpse, that'll cause the person to become a vampire. There are all sorts of you know, a bird flies over it. There are all kinds of things. You know, the seventh son might become a vampire, you know.
Yeah, I recall that list in the book. Yes. That the superstitions, the vampire superstitions, it's so strange, because we do still see some of those superstitions, actually a bunch of them. I was very shocked today in Appalachian folklore, which are also immigrants of European descent. So I found that especially interesting for different reasons, superstition for different reasons.
Like, sure.
The seventh son would have like psychic or healing gifts or something like that. But and the counting mustard seeds, that's in the book as well. I was like, what? Yeah, you use that against haints and witches. Stop them at your doorstep.
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but that was...
No, exactly. Yeah. There's all kinds of interesting overlap between different folklore from different places and, you know, kind of, oh, that's a vampire thing here. Well, that's a witch thing there or a ghost thing there or something. They all influence each other. I think in modern times, we like to put things in boxes. Like, oh, that's a vampire, and that's all the vampire stuff, and that's a witch, and that's all the witch stuff. But folklore doesn't have those kind of boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really interesting to kind of see that evolution of I don't know, the superstitions, the thoughts, the beliefs, the fears, and how that interprets elsewhere. Well, that being said, is the vampire like folklore, that historic folklore, is that strictly a European deal?
No. We tend to think of it, right, as European, Eastern European especially, but it's not sort of bound to that. Well, obviously it made its way to the New World, right? You know, we're talking about the New England incidents. Obviously, yes, Eastern Europe is very much present there, but you can kind of keep going in a wider radius. Greece, all the way over to the United Kingdom, up to the Nordic countries, then Russia, Turkey, even to China, India. It's pretty widespread in a lot of different countries, a lot of different places. So, certainly very present in Europe, not just in Eastern Europe, but Europe as a whole, but then even going over again to like Turkey and China, in those places.
Yeah. What's one of the more terrifying or weird versions that you've come across from another country?
One of the tricky things with vampires is like, well, what is a vampire? Because when you start, if you start reading articles or reading books about vampires, some people like they cast a really wide net when it comes to vampires. So like people love talking about this, but this often comes up in a number of different books where like in like Malaysia and some other Asian countries, there's this notion of a penanggalan, I think it's called, where it's not a dead person. It's actually a witch. And that's why I kind of don't classify it as a vampire, but it often kind of does get lumped in. It's a witch who at night, her head detaches from her body and her organs and entrails stay attached to the head and it floats around. Mm-hmm. And so it goes and will like suck the blood out of like children or whoever. And then it will float back to the body. And then I think it has to like soak its innards in like vinegar so it shrinks back down and then can fit back into its body.
So involved.
And so people would leave like thorns and stuff around, like the like branches of thorns. So it would snag its organs on it. So that's not necessarily a pure vampire, but it's definitely it's quite striking in the imagery.
Hey, David, welcome. Good to see you, man. Okay. Yeah. It's a lot of work to be a vampire. Golly. Yeah. Okay. Getting back to the folks. So a person is suspected, you know, that there's been a sudden death, sudden illness.
Yeah.
Somebody is suspected of being a vampire. You go and dig them up. They've got all the indicators. What are ways of solving this problem? What were ways of ending the vampire at this point?
So there's different ways, different approaches that were done, but they tend to follow a lot of the same themes. You know, we talked about staking a vampire. I think you might have mentioned staking at the at the top of the show. Definitely. Oh yeah, Last Voyage of the Demeter. I did watch that.
Yeah.
That was a lot of fun. So people would stake vampires. They would drive a stake into the heart in some places, in some cultures. We tend to think of staking a vampire today as something that's with a wooden stake is magical, has sort of a magical consequence of like, oh, that's a weakness of theirs. So if they kind of lunge at you and you stake them with the wooden stake, they'll die. If it was anything else, they wouldn't. But there's some sort of like weakness or magic involved mm-hmm. with it, I feel like, in a lot of shows. That wasn't necessarily the case in times gone by. In some of the accounts they talk about, they drove a stake through the vampire, pinning it to the ground, is the words used sometime. So really the idea was that the stake would go through the vampire and stick them to the ground underneath them, so then they couldn't actually like get up. So it was kind of a physical thing you were doing, a practical thing. Like, I'm going to pin it down to the ground. The wood that they would use, though, sometimes it was important the kind of wood they would use. They would use, like, depending on the place, like hawthorn or aspen or whatever, because they thought that wood made the stake powerful. Like, it had some kind of magical quality that it would work and kill the vampire. So you couldn't just use any wood. You had to use a certain kind of wood. The hypothesis is that the wood has associations to the crucifixion, and so it had sort of a religious connotation and thus a religious authority to it.
Sure.
But they would, so staking the vampire through the heart, or sometimes some places would use iron and stake it through the stomach or something. They might cut off the head, cut apart the vampire, that kind of thing. A lot of things to destroy the corpse. That was really, you know, kind of what they were looking to do, destroy it in various ways. Sometimes places would try, you know, in some places they would try different things in the stories and it didn't work. And if it really didn't work or they were really serious about things, they would burn the vampire to ashes. That was always like the end go-to. This is the last resort. This is what we're going to do. In some stories they start with that. We just burn it to ashes. Mm-hmm. In other places they might try a few other things and then burn it to ashes. But the total destruction of the body, and then they take the ashes and sometimes they'd scatter them to the wind or throw them into the sea or something.
Drink
like
it.
That. Yeah, or drink it. Yeah, yeah, or drink it. But you can see there's this notion that the vampire, it's a physical sort of in reality kind of problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so. A physical solution was needed, oftentimes to really kind of put an end to the thing. It wasn't, you know, sometimes there might also be, you know, someone doing, you know, prayers and an exorcism or something like that too. But by and large, you had to destroy the thing in some way. And then people kind of, there was a catharsis, right? Like we did something, we took action, and now, you know, we're saving ourselves.
Right, right. Well, reading about the various methods of, you know, killing a vampire,
yeah.
Got me thinking about the time period of these early accounts, some of the early accounts that you talk about, the time period at that time in Europe, and realizing that, you know, that these people were very ignorant to a lot of things that we might take for granted nowadays, and uneducated in a lot of things, and very fearful. They're fearful-based people. And they did a lot of not great things to things that they were afraid of, you know, people like witches. They did a lot of not great things. And so I was just curious, because they would go to these seems like very extreme lengths to kill the vampire. But what we're talking about here is a deceased body. In all of your research, did you ever come across any reports or indication that sometimes this took place with living people that they suspected were vampires?
When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
Are you or someone you know feeling overwhelmed by a mental health or addiction crisis? The Franklin County Crisis Care Center is now open 24/7 with care from certified peers and professionals. Learn more at franklincrisiscare.org.
Apartment People, champion, the trusted name in Columbus Living, brings you the District of Berkshire.
Man, it will be fun to live there, right by Tanger Outlet Malls. Oh my God, great location too, getting to and from Columbus, and a great deal right now.
Free rent until next year. Free rent until next year.
He ain't lying. Move in now, you don't pay rent until next year.
The District at Berkshire, available now at livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com. That's livewithchampion.com.
Yeah, well, there's certainly overlap between sort of witch folklore and vampire folklore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were beliefs where, like, you had the Strigoi, and the Strigoi could be living. It was a living person who's a witch. And after they die, they become an undead Strigoi, a vampire. So with the vampires, by and large, if they were thinking it was a vampire in the traditional sense, the finger of blame would often go towards a dead person, someone in the cemetery. If there were thoughts that it was more a living person, a witch, then you're on the other side of things. There was an account where I read where there was a farmer who he kind of got sick and he had a wound on his neck and the wound got worse and he eventually died. And there was suspicion that was a vampire, and then it fell on his wife who was living. It was a living person, and she was apparently very religious, but she took off. She left town. But then I think again you're getting that mixture of, well, it's a vampire, but it's a living person, so it's more like a witch. So I think the lines there could get blurry at times. And that's the thing, because a lot of plays they thought, well, if you were a witch in life, you'll be a vampire in death.
Yeah, right. Oh, okay. Okay. So that was one way you could become a vampire. Another way, Nosferatu with Willem Dafoe and Dracula with Gary Oldman and Anthony Hopkins ranks right up there.
One of my favorites.
Absolutely. Yeah, one of my favorites. Yes. What's another favorite for my listener here, David? He does like his movies.
Oh, I mean, any of the old Hammer movies with Christopher Lee, like, you know, the original is pretty good. Taste the Blood of Dracula. I like that one. Obviously the Universal classic with Bela Lugosi, Dracula. I like that one, a lot as well. You can watch the original Nosferatu. That's kicking around out there. It's a silent movie, so you kind of got to be ready for it, but it's kind of cool. You can, you know, kind of appreciate sort of the atmosphere of it and sort of a very early interpretation of Dracula.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, awesome. Find a copy of that, Dave, and we'll watch it for Patreon movie night. AP, let's talk about traits, because look, I will say I appreciated this book for a couple of reasons. I really appreciated the straightforward, kind of simple way that you laid out the information. It's a lot of information, but you laid it out so very simply. Anybody can consume this content. So if you just want to stick with what you wrote and get, you know, that way through the book, awesome. It's going to be an awesome read. But there's like this academic flair to it as well, where you include the sources that you used and links. You know, if folks want to dig deeper, they can. So this was my jam. Now,
thank you.
Like I was telling you earlier, I learned a lot of surprising info from this. And to the point, it's stupid but funny, but it's kind of like that feeling of, like, you know, I get to the end of the book and it's like, oh my God, is nothing real anymore? What is reality? I've been lied to. And I'm talking about the traits, you know, different traits and behaviors versus, you know, the historic folkloric version and our modern interpretation. Yes. And so to start that, I wanted to say, you know, I was surprised. So let me throw that back on you. What was like some of the bigger surprising discrepancies that you ran into when you first started digging into it?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, probably one of the biggest ones that you don't expect, because it's so integral to our vampire imagery today, are the fangs.
Oh, man.
I know. I know. It's so funny. Like I often kind of, if I talk about it, I sort of feel like I'm like ruining Santa Claus or something like that.
That was the biggest surprise for me. I will say that right out the gate, because they're synonymous with what we know of as a vampire. Like there have been scenes, AP, constructed in order to punish a vampire. You take its fangs. That's, you know, it can't be without its fangs.
I know. It's funny because it's probably the one trait you could show someone in a movie or something, and they'll immediately know what you're talking about.
Right.
Like all you need to do is have someone smile and they've got the two, elongated canines. And you're like, oh, it's a vampire. Like that, like that's all you need. That's really all you need to do, today. And people will know what that character is. So it's certainly surprising that it's really nowhere to be found, in folklore. They don't have fangs. No one talks about it. There's a couple passing references to vampires having elongated teeth. And sometimes people will kind of latch on and go, oh, see, those are the fangs. They're talking about fangs. And it's like, that's because you're coming in with kind of a predisposition to look for fangs, right? They say elongated teeth. They're not talking about just two teeth. They're talking about all the teeth. And that might be kind of attributed to like gums receding or something like that. So like the teeth would look a bit longer. And really, like that's mentioned very rarely in folklore with that. And I mentioned them in the book because I found a couple references, but by and large, no one ever says anything about it. The whole two puncture wounds in the neck, like that's unheard of in folklore. No one's talking about two puncture wounds in the neck. There's if there's a wound in the neck, which oftentimes there isn't, but if there is, it's one puncture wound. And that's that, you know, and or one wound. So I'm going to call it a puncture. It's just a wound. And that's kind of it. There's one reference too, where the vampire supposedly has like a barb on the end of its tongue or something, which I kind of find sort of
so
interesting imagery.
Strange, yeah.
But normally no, there's no fangs. There's no two fangs in the throat or anything like that. No one mentions it. That's a product of 19th century fiction. It was invented for someone came a writer came up with that, and it first appeared in a penny dreadful called Varney the Vampire. It ran for a long time, and it's, I think it got compiled into like an 800 page novel or something. That's huge, and that introduces like the two wounds and the fangs, and that just caught on, and that's now kind of with us. And you know, it is sort of, put it this way, if there's a show where the vampire doesn't have fangs, we have to acknowledge that in the show somehow. There's usually like a conversation where like, well, you know, people think vampires have fangs, but they don't. They'll put that in the movie or in the TV show,
right?
Because you have to acknowledge it, because people won't accept that it's a vampire without fangs. You have to hang a lantern on it and be like, nope, this is what we're doing with the character. But you know, there's a great episode of the X-Files where they went with a more traditional vampire, and like this kid has fangs and stuff, and then like he takes the fangs out of his, he's a vampire but he doesn't really have fangs, but he has fake fangs in, and he takes them out. So you have to acknowledge it. It's a given. But yeah, in folklore they don't mention it, and oftentimes there's no wounds or anything. Like people are getting sick, they're dying, there's no mention of how they had a wound, or there was some, this is where they lost the blood. There's no mention of that. There's no talk about that. It's simply they're losing their vitality somehow. Yeah. They're losing their life somehow. And you know, it's being done through sort of unseen means, perhaps, or, you know, the vampire's kind of sneaking in and does it in a way that, you know, doesn't leave some kind of mark.
Right. It is more, it's like magical almost, the
yes.
initial concept of it. It is more witch-like. I understand the, you know, not drawing of lines between that. It's a little bit more fluid. Well, you know, a couple of other traits, and I wonder maybe if you could just expand on them just so we can teach folks a few more. Just ones that surprised me. The needing to be invited in may not necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah. That's kind of an interesting one. That's kind of, it's sort of opaque. Like I looked through different sources and folklore and I'm like, does it ever explicitly say that this happens? And there's some beliefs that like approach it. They get kind of close to it, but they never really get there. They never really get to the whole, you need to invite them in so they can come in. There's some beliefs where a vampire would kind of go through the town and come to the front door and call out to somebody, you know, and if you respond to the vampire, that then you'll die. Or the vampire will injure you in some way or something. And so the trick was to not respond, or depending on the place, the vampire would only ask one other time, or they'd ask once or they'd ask twice or something like that. So you'd have to wait for the person to ask multiple times for, hey, you know, Bob, are you there? And before you should respond. That people, I think people will hear that and go, oh, that's the invitation. It's like, they weren't asking for an invite in. They were simply calling out to you, and your acknowledgement of them was the connection and thus kind of the foretelling of your doom kind of thing. So, you know, it wasn't like suddenly, oh, now they're coming in and hanging out. Like, that's not really what it was. It just, you know, it meant that if you responded, you would then die. So you kind of get close to it, but not quite. There's another tale where this young lady, like her paramour dies, but she doesn't realize it. And then he comes back to her house and calls out to her at like her window, and she doesn't know he's dead. So she thinks everything's fine. And he asks her to come outside with him. And the story kind of specifically states, well, he can't enter her house because it's clean and holy is the phrase they use. So even if she invited him in, I don't think he could have gone in. He had to get her out of the house because it was like a sacred place. It was it was a good place, and he couldn't enter a good place. So you really never, you get these kinds of notions of it, but it never really gets there. It really gets there with Bram Stoker and Dracula. There's a short story that comes before Dracula where there's another vampire. There's this vampire who's very kind of haughty, and he gets the people to invite him in, and maybe he needed them to do that, but maybe he didn't. And he's just, cause he likes making sort of like inside jokes that he's a vampire and they don't know it. Like he toys with them, right? Toying with his price. So you're never really sure, like, was he toying with them or did he really need that invite? But Bram Stoker makes it crystal clear. The vampire needs to get an invitation, and that's how the vampire gets in. And honestly, when you think about it from the historical accounts, like the notion of an invitation kind of wouldn't even kind of work in the incidents that happened, because people were dying, and it's not like they were inviting anybody in. They were just getting sick and dying. Mm-hmm. So that wouldn't have even quite fit with the events that sometimes people saw play out in their communities, where there was an illness that was going around or something else bad happening, a drought or something. But yeah, it wouldn't have quite fit anyway. So folklore kind of walks near it, but Bram Stoker kind of seals the deal and makes it clear.
Okay. You do this with so many traits. Any trait that you can think of that you associate with vampires, just anybody watching, listening on the replay, any trait you can think of, he's written about it in the book. And we won't say whether it's created or made it all the way through. but that being the case, since its publishing, have you gotten any pushback from, like, let's say, vampire purists?
No, I don't. Maybe they just don't know about me. I don't know. I'm flying under the radar. No, I haven't gotten any pushback on anything I've said in the book or any claims. And you know, some folks in kind of the world of more like vampire scholarship have seen it. And there was a review of it in the Journal of Vampire Studies. And, there was nothing, I don't think anyone ever said like what he's saying is wrong or something like that. I think from a scholarship point of view, I think I'm pretty good. People who are out there who kind of have their personal view of what a vampire is, and there's fangs and stuff like that. That's fine. If that's how you want to view it. I mean, one thing about even when you look at the folklore, like it varied from place to place. It's not like there's one solid list and everything else is not allowed or something. The vampire it's adapted over time anyway. So I don't get worked up if, people have a new interpretation of it, or they feel more drawn to like the Gothic vampire that came out. Because you gotta figure too, the Gothic literature and sort of the modern literature that followed it in the 20th century and today, it's speaking to people on some level. The vampire that haunted like the villages in Europe in the 1700s or something, that doesn't necessarily speak to us today.
Right.
We're not necessarily, someone gets sick, they go to a doctor and they get medicine. You're not necessarily worrying about that today. By and large, although I will say that there have been incidents in modern history of these vampire incidents happening in the 21st century, in some remote places.
Really?
But by and large, the general public, they're not too worried about vampires in that way. Mm-hmm. The vampires, that we see in TV now, that's what captivates us. It's this sort of suave, sophisticated predator that lures you in, that's alluring. But dangerous. Mm-hmm. That's the threat we worry about, right? Like someone I think I can trust and is part of my community and I think is an acceptable person, turns out that they are hiding something.
Yeah, it that is very interesting to look at the different variations, ones that you lay out, like in different areas, different time periods, and how it does change. And you said something about it reflecting. It reflects the society.
Yes.
It reflects anxieties, would you say? Absolutely. Community anxieties and fears of the time, and that is reflected in the vampire and a lot of the monsters that we create.
Sure.
What would you say that the current version of this thing, in America at least, what do you think that says about our current problems and anxieties and fear?
Well, I think oftentimes a theme that you see in vampire things today is the notion of the immortality of the vampire. Right. Like, that comes up a bit, like, oh, they live forever. Like, oh, that's, even in do you know the What We Do in the Shadows comedy show?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. It's a lot of lot of fun. But, they have their familiars who the familiars want to be turned into vampires because, they'll get to live forever and have these powers and stuff like that. So I think there's a bit of a focus on the immortality aspect of the vampire, and you even see that back in the 20th century. Like I think Dracula's Daughter is a movie, and they talk about that a bit even in that, and that's from many decades ago. I think we as perhaps society, maybe that can tell us that there's a concern about aging. And a concern about ultimately mortality and dying. We don't like the idea of getting old. We don't like the idea of passing away, of getting weak or feble or whatever. So much in our culture is about being youthful and staying young and vital and all this stuff. And so you get the vampire and all the vamp. You get these stories about vampires, and the vampire has that. I'm beautiful and young, and I'll be that way forever. And like, oh, that's alluring. But then at the same time, there's this whole dark side to being a vampire, of having that comes at a price, at the expense of other people, right? At the expense of kind of your soul and your humanity. So I kind of wonder if there's sort of a message there, either writers put in knowingly or unknowingly, that this obsession we have with perhaps youth or staying young forever, that it's ultimately kind of unnatural, and we shouldn't want to kind of subvert nature. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that today the vampire speaks to us about.
I got you. Thank you. Thank you for your just personal thoughts on that. Folks, the book is chock full of information about the folklore and the misconceptions between then and now. I would absolutely highly recommend this if you are a fan of the topic. David, you were saying, you know, you're a fan of those kind of movies. This would be a good choice for you. But thank you so much, AP, for that thought. And there was one more thing I wanted to ask you about before I let you go, and it's we're stepping out of the realm of the book and into the future, into the current time, I should say. The reason I asked about the purists pushing back. So I lived in New Orleans for a couple of years, and I am aware that in the current day, there are people and there are active groups of people who claim vampirism. They claim that they are. I think it is based on kind of more so our modern day concept of that. But I was just curious, in all your working on this topic, all your research, being that close to it, have you had interaction with any of these folks?
You know, funnily enough, no, I haven't really spoken to anyone who's part of, like, you know, the modern, like, vampire community.
Yeah.
You know, and I know there are some people who believe that they're vampires or they're psychic vampires, or they need some small amounts of blood from, like, a willing donor. Mm-hmm. And then there's some people I think who are more into, like, the lifestyle of it. They like the aesthetic and things like that. You know, if it's working for you and you're happy and you're not hurting anyone.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, hey, you know, live your life. but I think, for me, my interest and my research interest is always has been the folklore and the beliefs. And for that stuff, the vampire is a dead person, right? It's someone who lived and died, and now they are coming back in this unnatural state, in this unnatural way. And in the folklore there, it was nothing. It wasn't anything you wanted to be. It terrified people. It wasn't alluring. It wasn't attractive. It wasn't anything like that. It was scary, and it was something people wanted to avoid. And people would be afraid of vampires. They'd be afraid of becoming a vampire themselves if they thought they were somehow at risk of it. No one wanted that. You know, in times gone by, when you get into the Gothic literature, 1800s, suddenly the vampire changes and becomes alluring and attractive and desirable and all this stuff. And that's a trajectory that the modern world has kind of gone with.
Yes. Yes. David, in answer to your question, he's asking, what is the name of AP's book? It is Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. Check it out. All right, AP, we are at the end here. So let me ask our final questions to you. So, what have you got coming up? Any other further folkloric exposés in the works? Leprechauns, mermaids?
Leprechaun. You know, well, I've got the website, locationsoflore.com, that I try to, you know, post something every so often. I'm certainly overdue right now, but I was in Scotland not long ago, and I really like to write up some of that. I visited Melrose Abbey, which has a very kind of well-known vampire account that happened back in the Middle Ages. So that was fun. I talked to one of the people at Melrose Abbey asking about it, and they talked a bit about it. They were cool. Some, you never know when you ask about these things at a place if people are going to be kind of into it, or they're kind of going to be, you know, not comfortable with it. But so that was fun. So I'll be talking about that. And I am, you know, I'm thinking about perhaps another book where I explore some other kinds of topics, but we'll see kind of what happens there.
Okay, awesome. And where would you like to send folks online to connect with you, to follow you, and where would you like them to pick up copies of the book?
Sure. So, I mean, if you go to locationsoflore.com, I've got links to all my social media on there, so you can kind of see that stuff. The book is available on Amazon and I think a number of different online retailers. And I think if you go to, like, your local bookstore and ask if they can get it for you, I think they can probably source it from the wholesaler. So kind of wherever, you know, wherever you, whatever you feel comfortable about picking it up.
Okay, very good. And help me close this one out. You've been excellent. Help me close this out. Would you like to leave my audience with any final thoughts, words of wisdom, or a piece of advice?
Sure. So I will say, in researching my book, it was quite often that sometimes I would read something that was maybe on a website or something quite modern, and it would make some assertion about vampires. Oh, people believe this or people believe that. And then when I would look at older sources, go back and try to find the actual accounts, things were different. They didn't have some of the modern kind of expectations and stuff like that. So sometimes people would say things or post things, and they were being influenced by what their preconceived notions about vampires. So in the book, it was really important for me to kind of go back in time and try to like do my homework and get original sources. And it was good for writing the book, and I think it's good for in life in general. There's so much information out there, and you know, you kind of sometimes even I'll read something about a legend or a piece of folklore on social media. Is that true? And I'll dig into it. I'll try to find more. And so it's good advice really for anything. Do your homework, try to find the original sources, and then you can get the real information and kind of come to your conclusions.
Author, folklorist, that vampire guy, AP Sylvia, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Awesome. All right, I'm going to put you backstage. Okay. Oh, my goodness gracious. Learn more about my guest and his work at the links that I've provided in the show notes, and go request your own copy of Vampires of Lore, Traits and Modern Misconceptions. Request this from your local book dealer. It's like a drug dealer, but with books and better. So go do that, or you can purchase it online anywhere that books are sold online. Before you leave, be sure you give this episode a thumbs up. I appreciate it. This episode will also be available on audio platforms in the coming weeks. So if you want to help the show out, you can do so by leaving an awesome rating and review on your go-to listening app or website. That kind of support just really, really helps me so much. I really appreciate it. For show updates and announcements, follow me on social at Paranorm Girl Pod. If you have a spooky story to share and you would like to see it featured on the program, send it on over to paranormgirlpod@gmail.com. That's going to be it. That is a wrap for us for now. I will see some of you guys back here for the next live guest interview in 2026. Dudes, what happened? Where did this year go? I don't know. But yeah, I will be seeing some of you on the flip side of the new year for that next guest. For the rest of you, I'll catch you next week on all the regular listening platforms for our next solo adventure down the Appalachian magic, folklore, and high strangeness trail. So until we meet again, stay safe, keep the nightlight on, and sleep with one eye open.